All right, if you're anything like me, you hate running out of food on a trip. It's like a big fear. And so I'm a big fan of snacks during an adventure. And one of my absolute favorite go-to snacks are Wonderful Pistachios. You may be familiar with pistachios and the brand Wonderful Pistachios, but if you're not, they are one of the highest protein nuts out there. 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios is 6 grams of protein. That's 10% of your daily value. It also includes 9 essential amino acids, and they come with a ton of different flavors, varieties. There's a spicy version, there's lightly salted, there's no salted, there's so many. And every time I go on an adventure, I'm not even lying, I take an entire bag with me. And what's cool too, I love having the Wonderful Pistachio in shell, because then that almost gives me something to do and focus on as I'm paddling or biking through the really monotonous parts of the adventure. Every great adventure is going to have plenty of boring moments, and it's nice to have something to do and also something that is giving you some fuel, like Wonderful Pistachios. So they're one of my favorite adventure snacks, favorite road trip snacks, and definitely leave me feeling better than a lot of other snacks you can turn to. So if you want to learn more about how to fuel your next adventure with Wonderful Pistachios, go to WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's cowboy boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and the friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, that's fine. Just go to Tecovas.com. That's Tecovas.com. They offer free shipping on all boots as well as free returns and exchanges. They ship right to your door. Go to Tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today. And get ready for this summer. If you ever thought, can I pull off a pair of cowboy boots? Then you should pull on a pair of Tecovas and you'll see. They'll become your new favorite footwear. Cowboys knew what they were doing when they invented this Western wear.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason. Today's episode, we're talking to Caroline Paul about adventure as you get older. I think a lot of us think that, you know, our window of adventure is after college or before school, a gap year of some sort, before kids or after retirement. You know, what we're going to learn through this conversation is that life is long. You know, my wife always says, her grandfather used to say, if I'd have known how to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. You know, I think a lot of us just assume life is short, and if we didn't get into it, you know, years ago, we can't do it now, but that is definitely untrue. A big theme of this show is trying things as you get older, trying new things, trying new adventure sports, trying new experiences. A lot of the people we've had on this show did not find the thing they're known for now until much later in life. And it's so beneficial to be adventurous later in your years. And so this story with Caroline is about her pursuit of answering that question and finding those people, those women specifically, who are doing amazing things later in life, and the benefits and the science behind it. Her book about this topic and the interviews is called Tough Broad, and it's out tomorrow. And you'll be able to get it anywhere you get books. And what's cool is that Caroline is a New York Times bestselling author, but also an incredible adventurer herself. She was a career firefighter in San Francisco, only, I think, the 15th firefighter to ever be hired, a woman firefighter to ever be hired by the city, and just has done some incredible stuff. First descends down Whitewater Rapids, a lot of firsts, a lot of big adventures, a lot of mountain bike stuff, and just all kinds of really cool things all around the world. She's a pilot. She's done crazy stuff like wing walking. You know, there's so much. She's extremely adventurous. And so it was cool to hear her perspective and also her seeking out other stories. So I highly recommend the book. And let's go ahead and dive into this story. All right, folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. Today's episode is, I'm really excited. This is a really interesting premise of a book. And but today we're talking about Tough Broad with Caroline Paul. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mason. I'm really happy to be on.
Awesome. Yeah, where are you joining us today?
San Francisco, California.
All right. That's where you spent your career as a firefighter, too.
Yes. I'm not a native San Franciscan. The native San Franciscans need me to say that, but I've been here about 40 years since college.
40 years. Yeah. I mean, when do you become a local? You know what I mean? Is it 20 years? Is it 10?
Never. Nope.
Never.
Nope.
No chance. You're not a local. There's not many local native San Franciscans, I guess.
I worked with many of them in the fire department. There are many.
Oh,
but
wow.
They introduced themselves by generation. I'm a fifth generation. I'm a fourth generation.
You think firefighting is one of those things that attracts natives to San Francisco? It's almost one of those careers that has more than something else does?
I think that there's a lot of lineage in the San Francisco fire department. So it's because it's very old school. So back in the, you know, like certainly 50 years ago, really only locals applied to local jobs. And I don't know if it was a mandate. Well, you used to have to live in the city. So, you know, they already lived there. They often applied as soon as they could, 18 or so. And yeah, it was just passed on from in that era, father to son, and now father to daughter to daughter to daughter. It's pretty cool.
Wow. Mother to daughter. That's cool. We recently had a San Francisco cop on, career cop, and he third generation. And so that's the only example I have. And funny enough, that was kind of a family thing.
Yeah.
Interesting. I probably more so in that than like the tech industry, probably not a whole lot of generational lineage there yet.
No.
We're still kind of in that first generation. What I want to kind of ask about, I've got my notes over here. Tell us about kind of how you became so tough yourself. You know, you didn't grow up, and you're from New England, but I know you have a twin sister that took a different path in life. I know y'all kind of took a different path, but you got a brother that works a lot in this world and firefighting and whatnot. What were some of those early experiences in adventure and just being tough and being kind of taking the road less traveled? Did it start there, or did you kind of discover it on your own?
Well, I think it started there, but unconsciously, because neither of my parents were outdoors people per se. But, you know, back then, my twin and I were born in 1963. I'm 60. So we were raised in that era of free range parenting, where they basically said, get on your bikes and be back by dark. And even at dark, they forgot about us often. And we're like, where are the kids? And that was kind of how we were raised. And we spent a lot of time in the country. I consider my hometown to be a tiny rural town in Connecticut, where that's what we did. We swam the lake, we biked, we got on our skateboards to go to the local school. We skateboarded to school 4 miles. And so that was, and my twin and I always embraced adventure. We just loved that. We were steeped in National Geographic. Those came to our house, and we had them all lined up on the bookshelves like everyone did back then, those yellow spines. And I read every single one of them and was just intrigued by this idea of having a life of adventure from a very early age.
How about your siblings? Were you unique in that, or were they also similar?
Well, my twin sister is totally a badass. Like, she's an incredible swimmer. She can swim. She swims 11 mile races, 11 miles.
Oh,
she's usually like one of two people who finish. Only about 10 usually start, because that takes like 9 or 10 hours. She's incredibly, she's just made of iron in a lot of ways, but she did take a different path. She's an actress. She's well known as being on Baywatch for many years. And so most people recognize our face, but we joke because we are identical twins. I think we look different based on our lifestyle, but because I became a firefighter, but she was a rescuer on TV. So I was like, I'm a rescuer in real life and she's a rescuer on TV. And we sort of followed similar paths that way. But I would say that neither of my my brother and my sister both outdoors a lot, but they're not specifically adventurers per se, in that they don't think of their life in terms of what's the next possible adventure.
And you do. You've done so much, so many cool adventures. And I want to know, like, what was, you know, those early years of formulating what you wanted to do with your life? Because, you know, I know this book, Tough Rides, is really about breaking those stereotypes a lot. Your whole career was that in a lot of ways. And you talked about that a lot. And this is also as you age, like breaking some of those stereotypes. What maybe gave you that confidence in your youth and in your developing your career to say, I'm going to go this direction. I'm going to do something totally different.
I think actually, honestly, it was kind of being underestimated. I think back then, you know, certainly my dad was very conservative, very traditional, but just loved the idea of people that went off and did different things. And I think he allowed us, his daughters, he encouraged us to do whatever we wanted and sort of made us think we could, but I think it really came from a place of like, it's just a phase. You won't really be able to do it. Whereas my brother, I think, you know, the father-son dynamic is a lot tougher. There was a lot expected of him, a lot of pressure from my dad. So it was an interesting, and I'm also, let's not mince words. I grew up in a very privileged life household. So my parents believed in doing as varied things as possible. So they, early on, we were sledding, we were skating, we were skiing, and they didn't do it because they thought it would improve our character or be something that we would do in our lives. They did it because they wanted us to be simply well-rounded. There was none of this idea of like, if you practice bravery when you're a kid, you'll be brave as an adult. There was none of that. I don't even think there was the vocabulary for that. But I turned out to be, frankly, well-rounded in the outdoors. I think my role model was this mountain climber who probably your listeners all know called Dave Brashears, who was first a mountain climber and then sort of used his skills as a climber to become a filmmaker. And I modeled my idea of my own future on that idea that you could sort of be good in a specific niche outside. And then people would want you to go out there and do, in his case, film. In my case, I thought maybe I would be a journalist or a documentary filmmaker. So that's really the track that I was on. When I went to college, I studied communications, had my sights on kind of journalism, documentary filmmaking, like I said. But then I was radically derailed, became a firefighter, which actually did the same thing. I was paid for having adventures. And I'm so grateful that I had those 14 years in the San Francisco Fire Department and 14 incredibly high adrenaline years.
So is it really high adrenaline, like in the sense of, because I know a lot of things might look like that on the outside, but really it's like, no, it's a lot of waiting around and cleaning stuff. Like I work for a brewery, funny enough, out of Connecticut, and all the brewers are like, we're really just glorified cleaners. Like, that's all we do. And we pour some hops into the barrels every once in a while, but really we just spend 90% of our time cleaning equipment. Was firefighting like that?
Well, when I first got in, of course, all the old timers were like, kid, it's not like the old days. And it was 1989. And in fact, you know, the truth was that it's true that building codes had not yet upgraded here in San Francisco. And I think the real estate was not yet as valuable. So people were still burning down their own hotels, their SROs, or their own single family residences for insurance. And
holy cow.
Well, we're still drinking and smoking. And that was a big one. I went to a lot of big fires where we found a body in an armchair, you know, and it was clear with a lot of, you know, bottles around them, and they'd been smoking and falling asleep. And so there were, I will say that for all you firefighters who are listening right now, kid, it was so tough back then. Look, I was on the busiest rig in the city, went to half the city's fires on any given day. So I was called Rescue 2. And my training was to rescue in fires and also do any of the rescues necessary in the city. So that meant that I was scuba dived for bodies. Wow. I went to surf rescues. I was trained in any sort of cliff rescue, hazardous materials, tunnel, confined space. You know, we were sort of the Batman. we did it all. So we were also dispatched, Rescue 1 and Rescue 2. I was on Rescue 2 to any fire in the city at the time that was in our half. So, I mean, I had a 24-hour shift where I went to 3 greater alarms in 24 hours. Kids, that doesn't happen these days because real estate in San Francisco is pretty valuable and the building codes have really tightened. We did a lot of really exciting medical calls too, you know, and I find medical calls incredibly, they make you really think. I mean, you really need to bring up things like compassion, things that you're not specifically trained for, but are incredibly appropriate for really taking full advantage of being a first responder, which is such an intimate experience where you go into people's homes at the worst day of their lives and help. Mm. So yes, it was exciting physically. Like I don't want to sound like someone you don't want to hang out with when I say this. Firefighters will understand when I say we love going to fires. Like I loved going to fires. I also was really intrigued by medical calls because, again, I think they made me a better person.
And that's, like you said, that's a skill set you aren't necessarily trained to have to deal with, but it's part of the reality of it. I know. What would you say just on the general culture of firefighting, something that was missing? Like, what is it that personal, the personal skills that might not always be there with a lot of firefighters? Was there anything unique you brought, you thought, or challenges you saw?
I was super fit. I'd been a rower at Stanford. I had been already very steeped in understanding fear and walking the line of risk because I had been a whitewater rafter on a team that went around the world doing first ascents. I was already a pilot. I was in my 20s. I was in tip-top shape.
Yeah, that's pretty badass.
Well, I'm not saying that I came fully prepared to be a firefighter, but I really saw incredible acts of bravery when I was there from really decent men, people who really were super smart, the people I worked with. You know, they were not happy that women were coming in. I was the 15th woman to come into the San Francisco Fire Department, and there were 1,500 men. And you know what? I understood. I got it. Like, they had never seen women play sports because really Title IX only came in 1972. And a lot of these guys were in their 50s, you know, it was unheard of. So a woman fit enough to do this very difficult job was very unusual. And it is unusual. It's a very, very hard job physically. And I never took that for granted and understood that in some ways I had a disadvantage in that way, but it could be an advantage because I learned to look at every situation, understanding my own limitations. And I think I saw a lot of times some big, big guys not understanding their limitations. For instance, wailing at a door with an axe where I had a pry bar, look in the stairwell where the smoke is starting to fill up and we're waiting for him to get this door down. And I'm thinking, I never would have tried that. I'm strong, but I'm not that strong. I would have immediately popped that door with a pry bar and gotten it open a lot earlier than him. So, you know, there were definitely physical limitations to understand, but, you know, as long as you could, you know, had the right mindset, the bravery and the physical fitness, this was a great, and it was a great job for me.
What was it like to have your career cut short from knee problems? And also, you know, what were you going through at that time? Because it's from the sounds of it, it wasn't something you wanted to stop doing.
No, I fell in a fire and, you know, because there was I felt a lot of pressure not to be injured, not to show an injury. And also, frankly, it was snowboarding season when it happened. I was paragliding a lot. It was like, I didn't want to go off duty because when you go off duty, you can't do anything, of course, because you're hurt. So I ignored my knee and I really needed surgery and I ignored it for a year. And that set off a cascade of injuries that I would, you know, I regret so much. And eventually it just became stupid to, I remember I was carrying this woman down the stairs and she was very, very light, very light. She was 98 years old actually. And, but my knee was super swollen and I was, using the wall as sort of friction to make sure I can make the next step. And I realized, okay, look, your job, you have a lot of responsibility. Stop being so macho and go off duty and get your surgery done. And by then, honestly, it was late. It was late.
What was going through your head during that time when you had to stop performing your duties as a firefighter where you're like, now what? You know, I know journalism was one of those ideas. I know you were writing. You had told a story at that point. Kind of what was going through your head? And I'm sure the whole idea behind this book, Tough Broad, the idea of aging itself was probably just part of this. Like, tell us about that.
Oh, well, funnily enough, so I was 40 when I had my knee replaced, which was considered quite young at the time. So I feel like at 60 now, I'm in much better shape than I was at 40. I was on crutches for, I think, 10 separate times in 12 years, long stretches for surgeries. I had so many. And so I'm in much better shape now. So I never thought of it as aging back then. I just thought of it as stupidity, or I don't know if I put it together then. I think of it now as I was just dumb. I was way too macho, like, I'm not hurt. I think like any athlete who has to retire or quit their job for injuries, quit their sport for injuries, I fell into a huge depression. I hadn't realized how much firefighting was an identity of mine. I was like, I'm simply someone who does firefighting. I'm not a firefighter. But the truth was, it was like something had been amputated when I left. And it took me a while to get back on my feet. And I did become a writer. I joined a writer's community group called the Writer's Grotto, and seeing people around me writing and publishing was a way to get back into belonging to something bigger like the fire department offers. And also, I think there's something about writing that excavates something in you. You have to face yourself a lot when you write, just as you do as a firefighter. I found that when I was a firefighter, I really had to face like who I was. Like, was I actually compassionate enough to that person that we had to go to 3 times after midnight because they OD'd each time? Probably not. And you have to look deeply at yourself. And same thing happens with writing. So I think it took me a while, but I became a writer. I've now published 7 books. And then I also started embracing other things that would appeal to my adventurous side. I was already paragliding, but I transitioned into flying experimental trikes, hang gliders with motors. I was doing a lot of expeditions like sea kayaking through Belize, Croatia. I was mountain biking, doing bike packing, I guess they call it now.
Yeah.
We just called it bike long distance with stuff on your bike.
Yeah, bike packing's a little shorter, but yeah, I agree. I've taught others that have been doing it, and I'm like, yeah, that's bike packing. You just didn't have the word for it then.
I picked up surfing, which I am still not good at because my knees are so sort of, I'm sort of stiff. I look like Gumby, but I really in the ocean. Yeah. So, I mean, there was a way that I transitioned and I could keep those aspects of adventure and exhilaration, but I was no longer a firefighter.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that helped make this show possible. Are you looking to sell anything at all online? Well, I would advise you to look into Shopify. They are a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. I use Shopify every day at my day job. It has been with us since our company was a tiny little team all the way up to where we are today, one of the biggest breweries in the country. Whether you're auctioning off autographed apparel, selling sleek skis, or selling non-alcoholic beer like we are at Athletic Brewing, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their personal POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. We manage a podcast, a blog, all that right there on our Shopify store. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. and has extensive help resources whenever you're dealing with an obstacle. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ASP, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ASP for Adventure Sports Podcast now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ASP. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode. Identity reinvention. I'm sure that was, you had the pressure, the added pressure of being a woman. Did you see any progress in that sense in the 14 years of more acceptance of females in these roles? Like, did you see more of that in other part? Maybe not in your area, but other part. I don't know. Did you see any progress at all?
Oh yeah, for sure, progress. I don't. It's hard for me to pronounce, you know, things better, or because it's only my minute perspective, and of course, people around me, you know, weird things happen. Like I remember somebody, some guy, heard I was a firefighter, and he suddenly challenged me to an arm wrestling. But you know what the crazy thing was? And you know, usually men will beat women, but he was about 20 years older than me. And sadly, he lost, which was, I just thought, why would you do that? You don't, what could you possibly be proving if you beat
me? Quite a
gamble. And then, it was just the dumbest stakes in the world. And now I see CrossFitters. I mean, the women of CrossFit, I mean, they would just, they'll completely blow away like so many of the men in whatever they were challenged to in arm wrestle. So,
yeah,
I mean, definitely things have changed in terms of the expectation of what women can do, which is great. And, you know, more importantly, I think we have changed about our expectations of what we ourselves can do.
Well, take us, you know, you are obviously very adventurous, have done tons of different things. You just listed a bunch, but I know that, you know, it's books worth of stories. When did the idea of aging with adventure come about? And that's actually a topic I love talking about on this show, because it's always, yeah, it's a big topic here, because a lot of people listen to this show to inspire them to be more adventurous. And I think a lot of people have this thought, well, I missed it when I was in college, those free years. My next chance is retirement. But will my body be able to do what I wanted to do? I think there's a lot of misconception about it. And I was really excited to talk about this story, because it sounds like you wanted to write the book because not enough conversation was going on about this. Tell us about kind of the idea behind this and why dedicate an entire book to telling these stories.
Well, I was 50. I was sort of in my mid-50s and looking around, and I didn't see women doing the things I was doing. So I was surfing. I'm not a good surfer, like I said.
You're better than me.
Because you don't surf at all. That's probably the only.
No, I don't surf at all. Gulf Coast of Florida, not known for the surf.
I can paddle, Mason, because I learned in this just burly, burly waves out here on the coast of California.
Oh, yeah.
And all I learned was how to paddle really well. So I could go out in big things. I just scratch over the wave and then wipe my brow and be like, okay, didn't get it, but that was fun. So I was actually in the water looking around and realizing there's men who are older. They were in their 70s still surfing, and I didn't see any women. And I knew that there were still women who were way better than me that would, if they got in the water, they would just, yeah, they would be way better. They could totally handle what I was doing. And so it puzzled me, and I was on, you know, riding around on my one wheel and didn't see any buddy my age. Sometimes I saw an older man, but very rarely. And as well as flying, there aren't that many women. There are more and more, thank goodness, but still it's a, you know, I think it's definitely under 10% of women who fly. I can't remember the percentage, but it's I have it somewhere. But at my airport, there's experimental planes, and there's a bunch of us, and there's another woman. She's badass. She's my age, but really still very, how come there aren't, you know, 50%? So, and I started to think about my own future, like, wow, maybe I should pull back a little, maybe I, and so this book really, Tough Broad, is a quest. It is a quest. My other books, I think I was saying something, but here I'm actually asking questions. And my questions are about, my question is outdoor adventure good for us? I had a feeling, of course, that it was, being an enthusiast and someone who had really blossomed under adventure. So, but I really wanted the science and I wanted the psychology. I wanted to really look into it. And one of the reasons, let me say that I actually looked also around and saw that my friends were very much sad about aging. I mean, they were talking about, lamenting about it all the time. And I didn't feel that way. I have to say that I had a mother who blossomed after 40. She divorced my dad and kind of started a new life and was super happy. And then at 50 again, and then 60 again, when she picked up bicycling. And so I had a really good role model and a really good subliminal message basically about aging, but all around me, the women in particular, I know you probably have male listeners too. And I didn't write about aging, men aging, just because I didn't think that I was the right person. But of course, outdoor adventure is going to be good for them. But their messages, the subliminal messages men get as they age are way different from the ones women get. So I can't speak to the ones men get. I can postulate what they might be, but I'm very clear on what women are told, which is basically that we are on a decline. You know, our looks are fading. Our reproductive use is gone. We're not no longer interesting. We're cognitively, you know, also fading probably. Basically, you'll hear women say this, I feel invisible to the culture. We are not valued in this culture as we age. And you ask anybody who's certainly sometimes over 40, which is sad, but definitely 50, 60. And I had a sense, and I actually did a lot of research. And again, when I went on my adventures, was very interested in finding out about how does outdoor adventure, how is that a rebuke to all this subliminal messaging? How does it serve as an antidote for us women to break out of that and really begin to do the things that we know we can do?
What did the research say?
Fascinating. It basically says that your outlook on aging predicts your future. So if you have a negative outlook on aging, the studies are showing that you have an earlier risk of cardiac arrest, earlier risk of cognitive decline. And the opposite is true. If you have an optimistic view on your own aging, that you will have a way more vital and healthy life. And you'll live 7.5 years longer. And those years are good years. So that was fascinating to me because I've been very interested since my last book, one of my last books, The Gutsy Girl, where I really looked at the subliminal messaging that we give girls to pull back and embrace fear rather than bravery. Now I was looking at this other type of messaging about, you know, how bad aging is. And I kind of didn't believe it, again, because of my mom, but also because look at us, we're still physically healthy. I am at 60. And more healthy, right, than I was in my 40s. And we're at this juncture where we've got all this great life experience. And also for women, our hormones have changed. So, and this is actually on a hormonal level, our perspective has changed where we're turning away from taking care of others, which we did, and which is beautiful. But now we're looking more to ourselves. And that's not just emotional, it is hormonal. So that was all fascinating to me. And I had a feeling that outdoor adventure would be a great arena in which to find ourselves.
Tell me more about that hormonal change. Is that strictly mostly a woman's change going through versus a man? And what kind of abilities does that bring, that change? You said it moves away from more of a nurturing role. Do you feel like that's more... like what role does that play? That's interesting.
Well, so yeah, it's super interesting. And look, the idea of male menopause is still up in the air from what I understand. Like I'm sure there, of course, there's hormonal changes for men, but I don't know them exactly. I wish I did because I love my guy friends and I would love to have conversations about all this. It seems to be a quite a closely guarded secret among you guys, which by the way, menopause and perimenopause was among women for a very long time, until really the past like 5 years, I've seen a surge in conversation. And it's really important because the changes are, they're like kind of going through teenager puberty the other way. I mean, our hormones are going up and down. That's perimenopause. Luckily, my identical twin told me when I was like crying abruptly that, hey, I think you're going through perimenopause. So now at least I could be like, okay, I get it. But for many people, so then when you reach menopause and we were taught, oh, that just means we no longer have our pesky period, which always got in the way as an outdoor adventurer, right? As a woman. Now we don't have it. So yay. But of course, there's all these other interesting gifts that happen. And one of them is that the hormone, and I am not a scientist, and I read a book called The Upgrade by Brizidine is her last name. I want to say Lorraine, but I might be wrong. But anyway, it's very easy to find, The Upgrade. And she talks about the hormonal changes that women go through. And of course, you know, we have these caretaking hormones that mean that we are the caregiver for our kids, for our partner, for many people at our jobs, in our lives. That's a big part of who we are. And as those ebb with menopause, then it's not that we don't have that ability to connect with people anymore at all. It's just that it's changed. And those changes are fascinating. And I think for each of us, of course, they'll present differently. And this is a time to figure it out. And that's why I think that the proving ground out going outside is great for figuring that out. For really, as one of the things I did in my book was look at novelty and how learning something new is really good for the brain. Because of course, we're worried about our brain as we age. And I went and learned how to fly a gyrocopter. It was a big departure, even though I had been a pilot for many years. It was a very different craft. So it was a challenge. But Britta Penka, who taught me, was herself 55. And I said, hey, I'm 57. Is this really, am I going to be able to learn this really crazy, like helicopter looking experimental aircraft? And she's like, oh, you know what? Actually, it's a great time to do it, because it, for a lot of women, and again, she didn't know the hormonal thing. This was just intuitive for her. She's like, it's now me time. Like, we can now concentrate more on ourselves. So you're going to be a great student. And a great student, no. I was an average student, like I was, frankly, with everything. But I did learn better when I was older than when I was younger. My brain was definitely more of a sponge back then, but it wasn't also cluttered with that need to prove myself, that need to look really cool and, you know, get the concept really fast and don't ask those questions because you don't want to look dumb. Like, that's all gone when you're 57.
You stop caring. You're like,
yeah.
I was just talking about that with my wife. You just stop caring at a certain age. And my mother-in-law, who's over a lot, and it sounds like a great liberty to not care if I'm cool or not when doing something. Just ask the question. I need to know. Ask the question.
And now I can say, and it's not my fault that I don't care. It's my hormones have changed. I just don't care.
Wow, that's really cool. So, you're obviously wanting to know, like, hey, what does adventure look like as we age? What are some of the things that we can do and some of the ways we can benefit? Where did you go to get these stories? Were these people on the internet sharing this stuff? Did you have to ask around? Like, where did you find the
everywhere,
women that you talked
everywhere.
To?
It was hard. Yeah, well, it was hard because I think, and this isn't a knock on men, but they tend to tell us all the world about what they're doing. And I actually appreciate that because I love watching them huck themselves off cliffs and in their wingsuits. But you get a sense like, where are the women? They're not doing any of this. Well, the truth is, okay, they're still not doing it as much as we should, but there were more out there than I thought. And that was really eye-opening for me. So I basically went on the internet. I told people I was writing this book. People gave me names. And I went on a variety. This is not a book about biographies of women who do cool things after a certain age. This is a book about fulfilling aging and how outdoor activities can fit into that and why. The science, the psychology, the emotional aspects. But I wanted a range of outdoor activities. And I also didn't want these incredibly high adrenaline adventures because I knew that that wasn't for everybody. And I started to realize that the definition of adventure is more important than the actual activity. So adventure gives us exhilaration. It pushes our comfort zones. It's an exploration. We're on a quest, you know, all these aspects of adventure. So that could fit flying a gyrocopter, but it also fits learning to swim. So, or bird watching.
I was going to say bird watching was the other example, which that's kind of more my pace. You know,
I love
bird watching. And
are you a bird watcher, Mason?
When I can hardly set a goal out in nature because I have to stop and look at every little animal and saunter, basically. That's the goal, is to saunter. But adventure to me.
Well, that's what I learned. Like, I have to say that I went into I met with Virginia Rose, she is the head of this organization called Birdability, which brings people with disabilities out into nature to birdwatch, because she became an avid birdwatch a bird watcher in her 40s. And she was a firecracker, but she'd been in a wheelchair since she was 14. And noticed, like, there's all these walking people, as she called us, but where are the people in wheelchairs? And birdability actually expanded to other disabilities like autism or hearing or... but at the time, she's like, you guys don't understand us in a wheelchair. Like a simple grade that you don't even notice is really hard for someone in a wheelchair. Or, you know, the stones pinging on the wheels means we can't hear birds. So parks don't have, they don't work for us like they might work for you. So she, Birdability actually did this great crowdsourcing thing where they ask people to rate parks and talk about it from the perspective, for instance, of someone in a wheelchair or someone who has COPD and needs to sit a lot. Are there benches? It was a completely different way to be outside and amazing. But I went on this birdathon with her and have to say that I had never birded. I love birds as a pilot, but I kind of thought I'd be bored, honestly. I was almost like, yeah, I'm going to include this as a, in air quotes, adventure. But a little bit in my heart, I was like, yeah, that's not an adventure. And then I went because I was interested in how we can adapt our outdoor activity to suit whatever physical situation we're in. But I came away with such a wider appreciation of bird watching as an adventure, as a real adventure, because it had the whole rhythm of an adventure. It had the exhilaration, it had the quest, it had the long stretches of boredom that are also synonymous with adventure. It had the physical vitality because you're outside in whatever weather, whatever conditions. For us, we got up at dawn, before dawn, to see the dawn chorus, hear the dawn chorus, excuse me. It was eye-opening for me, Mason.
Wow, that's cool. I mean, it's a setting of adventure. That's where adventure oftentimes happen is nature, you know, not always, of course. You know, if you're in an urban setting, you can obviously have an adventure, but it's nature. And so whether you're flying through it, running through it, or sitting there looking, it's a lot of the elements are the same. It's more similar than it's different. You know,
right. And, you know, I think that I did a lot of research on the physiology of being outside because I wanted it to be outdoor adventure. I mean, I guess you could have an adventure on a climbing wall inside for sure. But true. Outdoor adventure specifically, biologically, is really good for our well-being. And there is lots of science on birdsong, on the chemicals coming from trees, on the meditation of walking through a landscape where it's not hard-edged architecture, but rounded shapes, stuff that kind of blew my mind. But it is well documented that being outside is key to our well-being, physical as well as emotional.
And I think I read that one of the important aspects of adventure, no matter how that is awe, is just being awed in the setting, awed by what you're doing, whether that's in a pipe of a wave while you surf or by a bird on a branch. And so I'm sure you saw awe in many different facets.
So awe was something that I was not well schooled in, to be honest. And it's recently, since I finished the book, really come into the public consciousness, I think, in ways that are so great. But at the time, I didn't know there were studies on this concept of awe. Awe has always been something, you know, that we relate to a religious experience. And in recent years, I have to say that this ties in, but I had become, you know, sort of that a little bit more someone who I realized wasn't as into the adrenaline. Like I wasn't into scaring the pants off myself anymore. So when I flew, for instance, and got into some really rough air, I can't say that I loved it. Yeah, I used to kind of love it. And so I was a little bit embarrassed by this. I thought maybe I was getting older and more boring, but I was still doing adventures. It just, I was very aware that there was been this subtle shift, but I couldn't figure out what was shifted to. I just knew that I wasn't that daredevil. I didn't think of myself that way. And I came upon this woman named Cynthia Hicks, who was 71 and went wing walking. Now, wing walking is this really obscure situation. A lot of people haven't heard of it. I don't blame them. I knew of it because, of course, I knew about the barnstormers back in the 20s when wing walking was huge, where people would, you know, transfer midair from wing to wing on two planes or from a car on the ground to a wing. They did all these barnstorming shows. But that faded and nobody does it anymore. There's one wing walking school in the United States that I heard about from this woman, Cynthia, because I saw her video of her wing walking. And I have to say, so I called her. And she said, oh, you won't. She explained to me that she had come upon this by simply typing in the internet when she was traveling in Washington State, something fun to do here. And she found wing walking and she loved it. And she said, you can't imagine the courage that you suddenly surges in yourself when you get up on that wing. And I thought, oh, God, no. Well, I can, but I can't enough. I guess I'm going to have to go do it for the book after. And I wasn't that happy about it because, you know, I'm not that devil anymore. And I'm a pilot. I was like, why am I getting out of a perfectly good cockpit onto a wing? So I went and, you know, kind of reluctantly to do it so that I could write about Cynthia and this idea, basically, of doing something once that's exciting and pushes your comfort zone and how that might change you. And I get there and I go up in the, we take this class, Mason wing walking, for all of you who want to do it. And I, even when I'm in the air, I'm like, oh, why am I doing this? And the moment comes where I'm supposed to get up on the wing and I stand up and the wind hits me. And I'm like, what? They didn't tell us. It's at 3,000 feet in the air. So a lot of things were, I was thinking, this is stupid. And I sort of walk all the way to the king post and attach myself, which is what I've been trained to do. And then the pilot begins the hammerheads and the barrel rolls. And it was amazing. I was immediately transported. And plus, my brain was completely blown, which I later find out is a key element of awe. Because I came off that wing like, wow, I'm feeling something. And it, of course, is completely awe, I guess, struck, awe, overwhelmed. I don't know what the word would be. And I started doing research on it. And I can't remember how I actually made the connection. Like, oh, my God, that I was feeling awe. Maybe because I just couldn't explain it. It was like a religious experience. It was like seeing something. I mean, my brain basically could not hold on to what I was doing up there in the middle of the sky doing barrel rolls attached to a wing. And that's is awe-inducing. Of course, now, you know, there's smaller ways to induce awe, like you said, and bird watching, going on walks outside, all that can induce awe. And awe is really good for us. It reduces inflammation on a physiological level, but it also changes our perspective, a more optimistic, compassionate perspective in the world, studies have shown. And so awe is implicit to outdoor adventure. If you, as they say, you know, access that childlike wonder in yourself, like we do when we see that bird that we were, you know, looking for.
Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. With any adventure, hydration is very important. I've been on so many trips where I've been dehydrated or couldn't stay hydrated enough, and Element helps anyone, including especially adventurers, stay hydrated. Without the sugar and other dodgy ingredients found in popular electrolyte and sports drinks, you don't want to have cramps and headaches and fatigue and brain fog or weakness on trips, whether that's training or out on the adventure itself. And having the ability to have something like Element there is so important. Element is a zero sugar electrolyte drink mix free of all the sugar and artificial coloring. Element was developed by former research biochemist Rob Wolf, 2 times New York Times bestselling author and one of the Navy SEAL Resiliency Committee members for over a decade. From Olympic athletes to special forces to health experts to business leaders to everyday health, Element is their go-to choice for hydration. Our listeners can receive a free Element sample pack with any order when you go to drinkelement.com/adventuresports. That's drinkelment.com/adventuresports. And you can try Element totally risk-free. If you don't like it, give it away to a friend and they'll give you your money back, no questions asked. I've been using it on rides and paddles lately and I'm really enjoying it. Element, stay salty. Football season may be over, but the action on the floor is heating up. Whether it's tournament season or the fight for playoff home court, there's no shortage of high-stakes basketball moments this time of year. Get in on the excitement with Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app, where you can turn your hoops knowledge into serious cash. I'm a big NBA fan, so I might be getting in on the action with some NBA games this playoff season. Prize Picks is the best way to get action on sports in more than 30 states across the country, including California, Texas, and Georgia. Testing your skills on Prize Picks this season is the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $1,000 with just a few taps. It's really simple to play. You can make your picks and submit your entry in less than 60 seconds. Download the app today and use ASP for a first deposit match up to $100. Again, download the Prize Picks app today and use the code ASP for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
What kind of doors only open for us as we age that our younger selves can't really tap into from an adventure point of view? I know awe might be part of that. I know maybe from just a time of life, like you said, not being caretakers or taking care of children. What kind of doors did you notice that, like, wow, that's only going to happen as I get older?
Well, I found that I'm having more fun in my adventures. So I used to go all around the world doing things like, for instance, you know, rafting first descents, and I sea kayak through, you know, the Aegean Sea, the first sea kayakers that turns out the three of us were. Wow. in Croatia to do these islands. Nobody had ever done sort of these overnight. We didn't know that, but when we got there, yeah, it was a fairly, you know, newly freed from war country, and outdoor adventure was not a concept for them. So, you know, being the first to kayak there and being the first to mountain bike in the Bolivian Andes way back in the 80s was a thrill. It was all kind of about the metrics. Like, it's not like I boasted about it, but there was something external about my adventures. There was something removed from really who I was, that I was trying to prove something. I, you know, was very caught up in the things that we are caught up in when we're young, proving ourselves, like I said, or finding our identity, and or latching on to other people's definitions of why we should be having sort of fun. And at this age, I am having so much fun doing what I do because I only do what I want to do or what I'm curious about. I'm not sort of buffeted by the youth sort of angst and, you know, flailing about trying to find myself. And so I think adventure, outdoor adventure now, just offers so much more. It just feels deeper and more satisfying, even though the adventures I do are nothing compared, like, no more first descents. You know, I'll get my paddleboard and, you know, paddle to the Bay Bridge and look around and be completely psyched. Kind of feels like a first descent, but it's not. And that's my life these days. And I kind of love it.
So, you know, we almost get better at tapping into real adventure, it seems like, with practice and with experience and life. What would you say are some other of those big misconceptions that maybe you held or you think that culture holds when it comes to our ability to adventure as we age?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, first of all, very first of all, is I think people don't think that older people, especially older women, want those aspects of adventure. They don't supposedly want to explore. They don't want to push their physical limits. They don't want the exhilaration and fun. Like, we're not fun anymore, supposedly. And that's, none of that is true. And I think it really deepens, and we can actually sort of, you know, osmose or take, we can bleed fun out of so many small things, which is not what young people can do. So I think youth and youth culture and our culture sort of those attributes are for the young. So you're not acting your age. If you want exhilaration, like when I get on my skateboard, that's not acting my age. And I guess that's not a positive thing. I should be acting. Well, I want to act my age. I'm psyched to be 60. I'm really psyched to be 60, and I don't want to be younger. And so, why isn't acting my age like getting on my one wheel? It should be.
I love that. So what did you notice anything about the people in your story? What would you say was a common theme that was very different about them versus folks not experiencing these things into their later years? What was something that they either experienced in their youth or something they decided to do? What was making that difference?
Well, a lot of these women had started their outdoor adventures later in life, which I found interesting. I was looking for a variety. Some people who, for instance, like Sean Brokman, who is a base jumper, she actually started fairly late becoming an outdoor adventurer. And she did a lot of things. She was a snowboarder. She's a trainer. A personal trainer, and she kayaks. She does everything. But she started later in life, probably because she's one of the reasons is she's African-American. And I think in this country, the outdoor industry has just marketed all their wares to white people. There's a subtle and not so subtle undercurrent of like the outdoors is for white people, not just white people. You got to be rich and you got to be robust, but definitely white people. So here's Sean. Now she's 54 and she's a base jumper. She's done heli skiing. I mean, she's an amazing outdoor adventurer, but she started late, as did a lot of the woman Vijaya, who I interviewed, who's from India. She lives here in California now, had never had an outdoor life. And she also started, she learned to swim when she was 68 and had, she said the breadth of her outdoor experience was badminton when she was young. And that was it. And so I was so impressed, first of all, that these women could take up something so new. But what was really became clear to me is that these women were living fulfilling aging rather effortlessly, because the outdoor adventures that they picked really did cover a lot of the pillars that we need for healthy and fulfilling aging. We actually need them throughout our life, but they become harder. So what I realized was that community, novelty, health, and purpose was all easily encompassed when you go out and do an outdoor activity. Mm. I mean, there's
just without thinking about it.
Organically, yeah, you're getting all that. I mean, sometimes in different proportions. So when I interviewed Miss Kitty, who's the oldest BMX, female BMX bike racer, she's 74. I went because I was interested in how competitive sports would be, you know, good for our brains, basically, or our personalities as we age, might give us some edge. And so she was a BMX bike racer, which is an individual sport. But I had completely underestimated how much community she brought around her. I mean, Miss Kitty's famous, for one, but the connections that she's able to make and the social life she has and that deep sense of belonging, not just a community, but a deep sense of belonging that is so important for our emotional well-being was something to be found in this individual sport, BMX racing, because the circuit was so close and vibrant. And she went all around, you know, she lives in Texas, but she went all around the United States racing on her own with her, driving her RV. And Miss Kitty is also, she's African-American, and she's become an incredible role model for people of color and women in this rather obscure but super fun sport of BMX biking, which she taught me, which I'm terrible at, but it was really, really fun.
That is so cool. Well, let me ask you this, because I know we're almost at time, but the book will be out March 5th. I see March 5th, 2024. So, and this is what I want to do. My wife, Emily, who is so great and so much more adventurous than me in so many different ways and so much, you know, more of a badass. how do I support her in a culture that might not always support women who age to be this way and do adventurous things? How do we as partners or brothers or spouses or siblings, you know, children even, how do we support the women in our lives who are aging and to be more adventurous? Because I know the desire's there, but, you know, there not might not be a lot of other support in a lot of ways. But how do we be supportive?
Yeah, I that's an amazing, that's a great question. I would say ask the women in your life to go outside with you if you are already an outdoors person. If you're not an outdoors person, which I assume most everybody who listens to your amazing show is, because you
either
really
are
do
or aspiring. Great. Maybe they're thinking about it.
Or okay. Well, you know, saying yes to any possible adventure is kind of how you start. Or like, I know someone who's, again, there's Cynthia who would write, who type in like something fun to do here. You could be that guy, Mason, who types in something fun to do here and then figure out some cool thing to do together. I would also say that I'm interested in the messaging so much, and I'm deeply admiring of the male psyche in this country, of how men, if you talk about messaging, the messaging that men get as in this country is to be brave, to be honorable, to be noble. I mean, there's obviously this all this other stuff, but there's some really great mindsets that men have. But I also see that it doesn't always mesh with maybe the messaging that women get and that we've absorbed and that we then express ourselves, the good stuff. Like, we tend to look differently at adventure, I think, sometimes. I don't, to be honest. Like, often I was the one who was, I had the messaging of let's go do it no matter what. And that was annoying. And I agree, it's totally annoying. But, and men would be like, no, I actually am. And I've had men say, look, I'm scared. And I appreciated that now, but at the time I was like, what? Like, so there are different ways I think that women can express themselves. These are broad generalizations, but as partners, as friends, understand that there's a vast way to enjoy an outdoor adventure, and that every outdoor adventure, there's a wide breadth of getting the exhilaration and exploration that adventure offers. So some people like me want to, you know, paraglide, but other people want to simply birdwatch, which is great. Nothing. And to be as partners, understand what works for the person in your life that you want to bring outside with you. Hmm. That makes sense. Or was that a bunch of,
No, I was just kidding. That was great. No, it's, no, like inviting, like that's, you know, that's with, I've talked to a lot of friends who are, you know, who are Black or a minority in the outdoors. And they're like, it starts with invitation. And so I think that's honestly how you break down a lot of barriers into anything new, whether it be, you know, coming into my world or me going into their world, like just an invitation and kind of hold my hand this first experience, sometimes literally, sometimes metaphorically, and just help me break down some of the almost the activation energy of getting out here, some of those fears. And once you realize, oh, that's not actually true, or I can do this, the momentum of that confidence can kind of carry you to explore it yourself is what we find. So whether that's camping or, you know, learning a new language, whatever something new is for anybody. So, well, where would you want to point people to find Tough Broad? Is there anywhere specific, or just start Googling away?
Just Google away. Okay. I'm, you know, you're basically your independent bookstore. Give them a call, ask them to order it for you. Go to your library. That's cool. Love the libraries. It's everywhere.
Caroline, thank you so much for joining us and telling your story and being so cool, doing so many adventures and allowing for bird watchers like me a space to also feel cool, good about
it. I know you're being very, very modest. I really appreciate you, Mason. That's really nice. Thanks for having me on. I admire your show. Thank you.
First of all,
thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.